for the invitation. It's nice to be here. So let me begin, actually. So the work I'll talk about today, I'm actually going to talk about several things since I'll be here for, I think, 2 weeks, actually. I want to talk sort of generally about a couple ideas I've been thinking about for some time with a number of collaborators. And I won't go into much detail on any particular topic, but since I'll be around for 2 weeks, hopefully if anyone wants to discuss, I'm happy to discuss in more detail. So I have collaborators at Cambridge, Malcolm Perry and his graduate student, Kate. I'm going to talk about something called moduli trapping, which is a paper coming out soon with Brian Green and his student, Simon, and Amanda, who I think is going to Cambridge now, and Janet Levin, his professor at Barnard College at Columbia. And collaborators at Michigan, Fred Adams, Sarah, who is here, Katie Fries, Chris, who's a grad student of Gorey, and this is the family tree. And I'll also talk briefly about something called modulated perturbations, which is work that I'm doing with Love Kaufman. So this is probably the most complicated slide I'll have. So I want to begin with a brief overview of inflation model building. So I'm assuming everyone here is very familiar with this, since one of the inventors of inflation is in the room. Then I want to talk about the current attempts to embed inflation in string theory, and I'll be rather brief just to point out a problem with such embeddings. This will lead to the idea of moduli trapping, which I will explain. And then I want to turn to the question of, given this string landscape, this large number of possible vacua for some fundamental theory, if we can actually make transitions through such a landscape and what cosmology might get out of that. And this will lead me to discuss, at this point, if you don't like the string landscape, and I don't, you can sort of cut this part off of the talk, and then we'll just go into some cosmology about multiple fluids and how going away from the model of a simple scalar, fundamental scalar field, you can sort of generalize the idea of inflation to look at something more complicated. And as a result, if you study the density perturbations that come out of such scenarios, you might get additional experimental signatures such as gravitational waves or different CMB predictions than what have been looked at so far. So in some sense, inflation is just getting started. And then I'll conclude. So it's often been said that in cosmology, it's only interesting, the only time you really care about anything is if there's a phase transition. The rest of the time, things are just scaling away and not much to be seen. But whenever a phase transition occurs, this usually can result in some type of experimental signature. So one phase transition that's sort of interest lately because of the upcoming LHC is the TEV scale, or the electroweak transition. Another transition that could have left interesting signatures for cosmology is the QCD transition. But what I'll be more interested in today is sort of higher energy phase transitions. In particular, the original models of inflation were motivated by Grandianification and what a phase transition might look like there. And then another sort of maybe two of the biggest problems for theoretical cosmology are these red question marks I put here. We know that today we've made some sort of transition to a universe with some dark energy. The universe is currently accelerating, and we don't really have a good explanation for that. And we know at the beginning, or at the highest energy scales, or the shortest lengths, we also had this period of inflation that seems to be a convincing scenario to explain a lot of observable problems. And it's kind of just interesting that, in other words, the largest scale and the smallest scale are the two that we know the least about. I don't really have any convincing answers for. So when these phase transitions happen, we can have first-order phase transitions where the new phase comes about through some bubble nucleation process, which I'll go into a lot of detail on in this talk. But these bubble collisions and the associated turbulence with the process can give rise to gravitational waves. And these have been somewhat studied in detail by Alberto Nicolis and other people around the electroweak scale, which supposedly can be detectable at LISA for that scale involved. And then, alternatively, the transitions we look at can be second order, which is usually the case in inflation models, and the inhomogeneous decay of the inflaton can give you observable gravitational wave spectrum, especially in, for example, the CMB. But I'm sure everyone's aware of this, I'm just kind of reminding you. So we get density fluctuations, We can have relic abundance as some species freeze out during some transition, such as the QCD transition. And, of course, you can also have defect formation, like cosmic strings of neutrino walls. So it's really interesting in cosmology when you have some sort of phase transition. That's the main point I want to get across. And one thing that sort of led to the ideas of inflation in the beginning was the idea that a vacuum manifold, when you go beyond simple abelian gauge theories, can be quite complicated. In particular, we know from QCD that theta vacuum can have a rich structure. And associated with that rich structure, we can also have non-perturbative behavior, which in recent years has made a lot of progress, recent meaning 20. Ideas such as Gaugino condensation and non-perturbative solutions that relate the different vacua of the fundamental theory. And more recently, the ideas of strings and brains and turning on other generalized fluxes, all of these can lead to a very rich vacuum structure for your theory. And given that we can have many minima in such theories, even in quantum field theories, we have many minima, the question is, what does this imply for cosmology? So one of the first people to look at this was Alan Guth, who proposed, in the case of grand unified theories, that a first-order phase transition could result in a large amount of latent heat that would drive an expansion of the universe. So in 1981, following Guth's first paper, Eric Weinberg and Alan looked at the example of an SU5 grand unified theory. Well, here the simple idea is that I start out in some false vacuum, I then tunnel through bubble nucleation to the towards the true vacuum, and eventually I end in the true vacuum, and the height of this potential, the potential difference, was supposed to give rise to inflation and cause the universe to go through a period of quasi-exponential expansion. And this was really amazing for several reasons. The main reason was originally the first reason this was looked at is when I break the SU5 symmetry, I would produce a lot of magnetic monopoles generically, and we, of course, don't want that. They would dominate and overclose the universe. So we had to have some way to get rid of these monopoles. And in doing this, they came up with this idea of inflation. So at the same time, to dilute away all the monopoles, you find that you can solve the horizon problem, the flatness problem, and the entropy problem, which were all problems facing theoretical cosmologists at the time, just by simply postulating that there was this period of quasi-exponential expansion. And perhaps the most compelling evidence for inflation turns out to be sort of an accident or a side effect of this postulated idea, and that was that you can get out a nearly Skell-invariant spectrum of density perturbations. So this is the spectrum that's responsible. These early universe perturbations could seed what astrophysicists had already observed and generated the large-scale structure in our universe. So when you look out at the sky and you measure the distribution of light and look at the way the galaxies line up, it was already well understood that this should be coming from some nearly Skell-invariant spectrum of density fluctuations in the primordial fluid. And the question was, what was the origin of these primordial fluctuations? And this actually, inflation was shown as a causal mechanism that could generate such a spectrum. However, it turns out that old inflation doesn't quite work, and it's quite simple to understand why. In order to get the universe, in order to solve the horizon problem, the flatness problem, explain why the universe is observed to be spatially flat, you had to have a large amount of inflation. And to get a large amount of inflation, I had to have a large drop in the potential to give me enough E foldings, enough expansions of the universe, to solve these cosmological problems, which happens to be 60 or greater E foldings. So if I do this, I have to have a large first-order phase transition. It would be very violent. But when I do that, and when I... So this transition, as I'll show a little bit later, proceeds by producing a couple bubbles of this new phase in a background of the old phase. But what happens is that these bubbles are forming in a quasi-de Sitter space. So the distance, the way this transition completes is by bubbles finding each other, annihilating, and creating the new phase. But if the bubbles can't collide with each other rapidly enough, then the transition can't complete. And in the case of having a large, essentially cosmological constant, the acceleration doesn't allow the bubbles to find each other, and therefore they can't collide with each other, they can't percolate, and the new phase can't be realized. So instead we end up in a big bubble universe, and it's a sort of false vacuum eternal inflation. You're in this large bubble that never comes to the new phase. And there's a number of other problems, but I'll come back to this. But so thus far, this is just a review. If there are any questions, please interrupt me. So following this this very pleasant idea, this sort of framework to solve all these cosmological problems and explain a lot of observable experimental signatures, there was a lot of work that continued over the next 20 years, which I'm really not doing justice to by flashing all this. But so this is just a list of some of the models. And each time sort of an idea is produced, and then people go looking at the latest, in this case, string theory now, but back then, grand unified theories, we're always searching for some fundamental UV completion for any toy model we would write down for inflation. But I guess it's fair to say that there's really been no convincing, overwhelmingly convincing model. And I guess this is sort of a bottom-up approach in the sense that I don't look at, as in the case of the SU5 transition, where I actually looked at the SU5 model, and then I wanted to see some phenomenology coming from it, and I got inflation. Here, we have inflation, and we're trying to sort of go back up and find some fundamental theory it lies in, which is, in some sense, an act of construction instead of maybe natural or pleasing. But needless to say, people continue.
And the telltale thing is the word inflaton.
Yes.
Which you should never have to have if you're starting from your own.
Exactly. That's right. Exactly. So more recently, there's been a lot of people.
One thing on that previous transparency. You say, I haven't studied all these models, needless to say.
Neither have I.
But you say none of them have a proper ultraviolet completion. I thought some of them did.
Well, I guess it depends on
what do you mean by what do you mean by no ultraviolet completion?
Well, I guess ultimately all of these would have, if I want to have a theory that has gravity with my quantum field theory, it would have to be a completion in string theory, and I would argue that there's no complete model of inflation coming from string theory.
Okay.
And in particular, it sort of lies at the fundamental level that time-dependent solutions in string theory are hard to come by. And so that's what I'm thinking about.
Okay.
So is the way you've put this, I'm guessing that you're thinking all these things people call fine-tuning, well, until you have a UV completion, you don't quite know what you might hope to work out. So you're kind of putting it all into that.
Yes.
Yes. Good.
Absolutely. That's nice. So the latest effort has been to sort of take a certain corner of the string theory moduli space, look at an exact string construction, an exact branch of string theory, and then to see, is it possible to get the right scales out, the right things that we need for inflation at all, but coming from the top down, in the sense that you're starting with the fundamental theory. Of course, this is one of an infinite number of possibilities, so it's not that appealing, but the approach allows you to ask some questions about, is it even possible? So this started with much earlier work, but it was sort of popularized by KKLT, and then it was enhanced by these authors, and I sort of put this as a joke, but as you can see, the more realistic you try to make the model, sort of the more authors that go on the paper, and then it just grows out of control. But the basic setup is the following. So if you start in string theory, which is the most promising quantum theory of gravity, you generically have the presence of lots of moduli that parameterize these, that are parameters of the theory that have to be determined. And one of the things that was stressed in KKMMLT is that if we don't stabilize these moduli, they'll have effects on our inflation that we don't want. So that's one of the first obstacles in going from string theory to some sort of phenomenology is we want to stabilize these moduli. So the authors accomplished this by taking static configurations, wrapping fluxes on the various cycles of the extra dimensions, and in this way you can stabilize most of the moduli. Then you're left with these warp throats where you put stacks of d-brains, and I stack these d-brains to warp the geometry, and it makes a throat region. At the bottom you have some cascading gauge theory, and at the top you have some UV theory that you don't quite understand, but in this throat region you can build models of inflation. Now, this all might sound extravagant and perhaps insane that I'm even presenting it, but what's nice about this actually comes from type 2B string theory, and this throat region is actually the Randall syndrome picture that was originally just sort of cooked up as a phenomenology of string theory without any instruction. So what this is the type 2 realization of Randall syndrome cosmology. So then the typical scenario is we put some probe brain here, some D3 brain. As this D3 brain goes to the bottom of the throat, which has anti-D3s, this generates a positive vacuum energy term, which would give rise to inflation. inflation would end once the brain ends the goes to the bottom of the throat, and then we would be left with some minimum, which is typically an ADS minimum. So inflation is over, you're in some universe at the bottom of this throat with some cascading gauge theory, which hopefully once upon a time would match with the standard model, and this would give you the entire universe as we know it from string theory. Of course, we know we live in a de Sitter minimum, so what KKLT actually did is they showed that you could lift this naturally ADS minimum to some de Sitter minimum. So here I have a graph of the potential. This is a typical example from Gugino condensation. These are non-perturbative effects you turn on. By turning on these non-perturbative effects in string theory, you get this small minimum, and these are different models. This is a D3, D7 model I've drawn here. This is another model. This is very close to the line, but that's because the cosmological constant is almost zero today. But what they showed is that by turning on these fluxes and adding non-perturbative objects such as brains in your theory, you can get a de Sitter space today. You don't explain why it's so small, but you can get de Sitter space from string theory, and you can get a model of inflation.
So maybe I should already know the answer to this, but I don't. So when you say we're obviously de Sitter today, you've just shown a mechanism for inflation. What happens when you just try to duplicate that to get the acceleration today rather than...
Oh, you mean with the brains?
Right. Or is the problem is you're supersymmetric and all that, so you've got that to deal with.
No, I think the complete picture hasn't really been worked out very well, but the way I sort of view this is I kind of don't like these pictures. I think they're sort of insane. But if you collapse all this to a four-dimensional effective field theory and then just view this as a way of visualizing what's going on, in some sense, because fluxes are dual to brains, they're almost the same idea. So the basic idea is if I turn on fluxes or I put in some brains, I can generate de Sitter spaces. Mm-hmm. And then it's just a matter of tunings, because you're tuning it so you get what you want.
So the picture of inflation is one that definitely, you know, decays.
No,
it's sort of semi-classically or something. And, I guess, I don't know. Are you saying that if I look carefully at the dual, this tunneling through the landscape is going to look like this rolling here?
Well, so you're anticipating the rest
of
the
talk. Oh, I see.
So, okay. This is a general...
Happy, so I planted a good question.
I wanted to do a slight aside before I get to that and just point out something about this. So long ago, Brustein and Steinhardt pointed out that if you had such potentials... in the early universe, you generically expect your moduli to have its finite temperature. The early universe is a very hot place, and any fields around should have some initial kinetic energy. So in particular, if I start some ball or some scalar field rolling here, typically I would expect it to start up at a high energy scale. And in fact, if you notice this is a 4, if you actually do this and work this out, you would start up in the ceiling and just come rolling down, and there's no way that you wouldn't just shoot over top of this minimum. So this is the overshoot problem. The string theorists have a different name for this. It's the Dyne-Zyberg problem. But the point is that there's more phase space that lies at large volume than at very close to none. So it's a large fine-tuning to just take a particle and sit it here. So I want to talk briefly, as an aside, about a mechanism that could actually explain why you might find yourself at such a minimum.
Let's see. Another question is, I guess it's still the case that in string theory there's no particular preference for this configuration that anybody can figure out.
No,
right?
That's definitely true. And in particular, we know that the endpoint where we want this model to end up at the end, it needs to have enough symmetry to embed the standard model. So that's one of the things I want to motivate with this next little...
So, Scott, do they ever actually specify an intuitive link between the shape of the geometry and the durational inflation? Well, there has to be one. You know that if, in fact, you had a warped throat, which was ADS all the way to infinity, and you just detuned the brain against the Bach cosmological constant, you would get, quote-unquote, eternal de Sitter space. Of course, that's not a solution of string theory and so on and so forth. But who cares? Just that the geometrical description, there has to be some way of simply stating criteria as to how long the throat needs to be in order to... Or something,
yeah. I don't know of that, but those are the sort of questions I think would be interesting to look
at.
Yeah. No, it's something I can't find anywhere.
Okay. Because end of inflation happens because the warp throat is not exactly ADS. It's sort of geometry up there knows that it needs to convert into this whatever, you know, the conic protuberance, you know.
Yeah. No, Putting all this together in a complete package is something that I haven't seen.
Let's see, there's an implication of your question. Are you saying that inflation occurs during the ADS phase and then it exits inflation by going...
Well, that's that in itself is kind of confusing. So, I mean, the idea is you're in this region that admits a description as ADS5 plus S5, but then I put some brain configuration in that which introduces a de Sitter space on top of the ADS5
that dominates.
Right. So it's... Yeah, I mean, as a complete picture, it's a little confusing.
But just a small comment. The reason of the difficulty of getting something like this to explain acceleration today is the problem with inflection. If you break supersymmetry at a high scale in the standard model, why would that not, by gravitational mediation, affect the dark energy sector and destroy the star?
Right.
But I think that's what he meant by sort of saying that this hasn't been worked out. It's not really known to how.
Yeah. Okay. So again, I want to argue for two things: one, why we might find ourselves in that minimum, and the other is why the symmetry at that minimum might be higher than somewhere else. So to do this, I have to introduce a little bit of string theory jargon, but not much. So if I just look at the simplest thing I can look at is having some four-dimensional Minkowski space with a circle. So I have a Kaluza-Klein compactification, but now I have strings that I'm compactifying instead of just the usual Kaluza-Klein. So I have some scalar phi, which is associated with the radius of the circle. And then I can have some gauge field that is related to the fifth component of the metric. But because this is string theory, strings also carry flux. And so I also have this B field. And so the U1 theory I get, instead of being the usual U1, it's a chiral U1 gauge theory. So this is the first example of how strings are different than point particles. But then a simple example of how I can get the symmetry enhancement I want to explain is if I take one of these strings and look, for example, at a winding string, this is a string that wraps this extra circle, then the mass of that string is set by this vacuum term, this tachyon term, and it plays off against the radius of the dimension. This omega is a winding number, and this is the string scale. So it turns out that if I look at strings that wrap twice, either left or right, so they have a winding number of plus or minus 2, then the mass of those winding modes against this negative term, the mass of the winding mode when this radius reaches the string scale becomes exactly massless. So the point is that this string will be very massive. It will have some string scale mass, and I would integrate it out of my effective theory, and it wouldn't play any role. And I would never see the presence of this state. But if I go to the special location, which is the self-dual radius, it's where it's a fixed point of t-duality in string theory, this massless state would then need to be included in my effective action, and I need to integrate it back in. So in other words, this is sort of like the Higgs mechanism in string theory. But so the point is that if I just wrote down generically some effective Lagrangian and claimed I was doing string theory, without this knowledge of the underlying string state, I would miss this light degree of freedom that's near a specific place. So the question you can ask, and in particular, in this case, if I go to this special radius, what I have is this chiral U1 theory is now being lifted to an SU2 gauge theory. So this is the idea of symmetry enhancement in string theory. This is probably the simplest example. What's crucial here is this is for a heterotic string, so that's why I have this minus 4, this tachyon-like term. But it turns out that such symmetry enhancement is quite common in string theory.
Hold on. So you're saying this is a time-dependent thing, that is, that this radius is changing as...
Well, I want to make it that, yes. Yeah. So in string theory, I wouldn't have the time dependence, and I would have some conformal field theory for each value of my radius, and there'd be one conformal field theory that has this state in it. But I can lift this and make it weakly time dependent, and then this will act like a... In that way, the radius
so
acts like a Higgs particle.
So you're only going to have this enhanced symmetry at one point in time.
Right. Right.
And when is that point?
Whenever phi, this field I've defined as phi, which is a...
But I mean...
Whenever it hits
where
zero.
Where in this whole scheme is that going to be set?
If and when it passes through zero.
No, but I mean, is that something that happens Big Bang time or now or...
Well, you can... It's free to... You know, you can play with it and figure out which one you like. So it's a matter of initial conditions.
But it must affect the phenomenology.
Yeah, I know. So that's what I'm going to say.
Oh,
yes.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
Well, but before I do that, just to point out, so this phenomenon I'm describing very elementary, it actually occurs all over, it's ubiquitous in string theory. For heterotic strings on T6, On type 2 theories on K3, there's singularities and additional states occur. So that covers all of string theory. It also is true in M theory. And furthermore, anytime I wrap brains or strings around cycles that collapse, which is a common phenomenon near points of conifold transitions or flop transitions, or maybe another simple case is if I have two brains that are separated by some large distance. Here phi plays the role of the distance between the brains. So if I have some open string that's stretching between two brains, the string is very heavy and I would integrate it out and it wouldn't affect the dynamics of my theory. But then when the brains become very close together, this open string becomes very light and it becomes massless, and this gets lifted to some U2 theory. So that's another simple example of where you would have a symmetry enhancement. Okay, so now to sort of a toy model of how you could use such a thing. So the first paper on this was by Kaufman et al., and I had done some work at the same time. And then later, me and Sarah extended this to the case of the dilaton. And this paper with Brian Green and collaborators coming out soon, we're going to review all of these possible applications. So the basic model is the following. I can imagine I just have two scalars here. Phi is the, say, radius of the circle that has the string on it, and chi is the string state of this winding mode that becomes light. You can see that because I have the mass term for the generated by how far away I am from, the, in that case, the self-dual radius. So initially, I say that this state is very heavy, so I shouldn't have any quanta, and so the VEV of chi squared is zero. But then if I allow phi to wander through this sort of string landscape, if I just take phi at some initial point, it has some kinetic energy and it's rolling around, but once it passes through, and if it passes through this enhanced symmetry point at phi equals zero, then the non-adiabaticity of the state can generate particle production. So a good way to measure whether you get the quanta of chi excited is this dimensionless quantity, the change in the frequency of the state, which is just this quantity here, divided by its frequency squared. When this becomes order one or greater, that means I get particle production. And so what happens is that this particle passes through this enhanced symmetry point. So let's say that initially we have no potential at all. So it's just some moduli field rolling around in some flat direction. As it passes through the point phi equals zero, I will get this particle production of these chi states. But then as it goes away, the mass of chi will increase in a time-dependent fashion, and these states will back react and pull phi back towards the enhanced symmetry point that it passed. So then phi will turn around and come back, but then it'll pass through this non-adiabatic region again and produce more particles. And each time it will do this, it will create some enveloping potential that will increase more and more until eventually phi will get stuck near the point where the chi state was massless.
So you're saying particle creation, but this is something I can visualize in a completely classical field theory.
I think so.
You're just sort of getting the chi rolling, so it destabilizes chi, it starts to roll, and then it gets stabilized again, but presumably has a...
Yeah, you can think of it as like, in fact, the original reference to this type of idea is probably the work on preheating by Kaufman, Lindy, and Starobinsky, where you just have your exciting modes of an oscillator through parametric resonance, more or less, yes. And you can, of course, calculate the number of particles you create, and it goes like the initial velocity of the modulus that was rolling around, how coupled it is, g is the coupling, and then k is the momenta of the particle. And so if you go through and calculate chi squared after you produce these particles in your own shell, you get this always attractive force pulling you back towards this enhanced symmetry point. And the only interesting comment about the particle production is, as you can see, this graph is of the non-adiabaticity parameter. You can see that it's sharply peaked around the value of phi equals zero, so this is an instantaneous event. So in other words, you have a particle rolling in, you just have a burst of particle production, and then the particle rolls out. And so this term will pull you back and trap you at this value of phi equals zero. So one thing I'm not going to say a lot about, I'll just refer you to the paper, I'm happy to discuss it, is if you turn on the Hubble friction term, what then happens is this behavior can become quite complicated. And in particular, before I actually get to phi equals zero, I could have enough damping so I would get close to phi equals zero, but not exactly at phi equals zero. So in other words, this is a way to generate small numbers. So for people that like naturalness, if you built this into some fundamental model, then you might be able to explain why the VEV of phi has some very small value. This, of course, is a modulus, so it determines the mass of other particles. So that's just
once you have another question on the picture. So if phi is not headed towards this ESP point in that plane of spaces, then this doesn't happen at all. It remains adiabatic. Is that right?
That's right.
So you have to.
So it just continue to
run. Tuning associated. Is there?
Well, so then you have to
connect it to the ESP point.
You have to appeal to something that I'm not a big fan of. But the idea is you're going to have a landscape of these vacua. And in any string theory, there's an array of these enhanced symmetry points. So you're going to pass through some, and in fact, again, oversimplified, as phi passes through here, if it has a lot of kinetic energy, or in the early universe, it moves a lot, you would pass through here, lose some energy to producing these particles, but then continue to go. Maybe they decay into something. It would be very complicated. And eventually, you'll pass through enough of these points that you'll slow this thing down, but the point is you'll find yourself near a place that has more symmetry than away. So if you
take that's where the friction is,
right? Also, yeah. So if you turn on the fluxes that KKLT did, you've traded a continuum of parameters for a discretum of flux quanta. Then if you activate this mechanism, you're explaining why you might be near one of these points that has more symmetry than another one, and so you're beginning to sort of maybe very crudely do dynamics on this landscape. But your question's a good one, so. Let me postpone it 1 second, but I'll come back to that. So just some observations about this. Just a couple quick comments. One is that, as Voth has pointed out in a number of papers, the basic notion of enhanced symmetry is an important one, because when you're naively making statistical arguments about a landscape and treating all effective field theory Lagrangians equivalent, you're going to miss these other additional light states that string theory possesses that low-energy supergravity does not. So that's sort of an interesting point. And there's many examples of that in string theory. The other thing is, if you found yourself fixing these moduli before inflation or before some other phase transition, if they're at a location of enhanced symmetry, these are guaranteed as minima of the effective action for all time. So even after the phase transition, these moduli will not be displaced from their minima, which will prevent this moduli problem of moduli oscillating and ever closing the universe. Another thing is, just aesthetically, from the string theory point of view, it's sort of nice to realize that all these moduli will be stuck at fixed points of duality, but that's more of a string theory point of view. And last but not least, so most of these constructions are done at very weak coupling. So one probably the most challenging modulus to deal with is the dilaton, since it determines the string coupling. And so Sarah and I tried to initially investigate this, and we found that in principle, there are states that exist that should fix the dilaton, and if you play around with these from a sort of cosmological point of view, you get nice consequences out. However, the states have not been identified in string theory, and in fact, you actually have to calculate this in M theory, and it's very challenging. But this would be, it would sort of complete the cycle, because, as Voth pointed out, in the T-duality case, you can show that all the moduli should probably be stabilized at fixed points of T-duality. But this would be an example of fixing the dilaton at a fixed point of S-duality, where in some sense we don't have a weak coupling or a strong coupling expansion. So you're right in the middle where we can't calculate anything. So it's an open challenge to try to understand essentially what to do with the dilaton.
What do you mean? You only mean the sort of environmental friction effects that keep you in some region of space, or you also, as you know, mean to that you need to give it a mass which is going to make sure that it stays there even after everything else in the universe redshifts away?
You've undermined anything I can say beyond what I said. No, that's the big problem, is to understand how to give it the mass. I've given you what,
so
yes,
you're
precisely.
You're saying here are these evolutionary, I'm just checking, so just that I understand. So you're saying these are all interesting evolutionary transients.
Right.
That may operate at some times.
Right.
But for the ultimate stability required for phenomenology, you still need to get the mass.
Right. Yeah, it's not clear how this works in with the giving a mass argument and being less than the Hubble space. Okay, so now let me return the question, what happens if we don't get stuck at this ESP? Okay, so I stole this from the Manus paper. This is a sort of stereotypical setup in the string landscape. These different numbers are, again, the picture I had before, but I can have different numbers of brains sitting in some moduli space. Each stack of brains will warp each throat differently. This region is the Calabi-Yau region, so this is some UV physics that we still need to figure out. And the basic question is, if you start near one of these one of these locations in the landscape, if you don't become stabilized there, you could, in fact, tunnel from one of these to the other. And I use the word tunnel loosely because it's not clear that it's tunneling. We can sort of suggest the idea of going from throat to throat by drawing a potential that looks something like this, but it's not really clear whether this is a first-order phase transition or a second-order phase transition.
You could have enough kinetic energy just to...
Yeah, you could just roll over the top. Of course, one thing, again, in these constructions seems to not be stated much is this is finite temperature, so I could have temperature effects, thermal fluctuations, or I could be tunneling from minima to minima. So it's really, I guess there's a lot of work to be done to examine it. The first thing I want to entertain is the idea that it might be first order. So let me say something about first order phase transitions. So I guess...
Well, I'm glad to hear you say all that, because it's remarkable how people sort of settled into one view of this without...
Yeah, no, I think part of the challenge is that if you get into the stringy details, it's really hard to write down these models. So it's, but there is a lot of room to do phenomenology if we ask the right questions. So before I go on, I want to make sure that everybody is okay with this picture. So I guess the typical example that you would have in the current literature is, I would have some throat here that I would do my inflation model in. I would put some D-brains. D-brain inflation, I would get some, and this would be the inflationary throat. Later, this throat, after reheating, would need to couple to some standard model throat where we have a brain configuration that represents a standard model, and the coupling between these two would take me to what I see today. And then I could have another throat with causal strings living in it, and at the end of the day, I sort of collapse all this to some four-dimensional effective field theory, and what it's doing is explaining to me where those parameters of my theory came from. So it's a justification for all those toy models we like to play with.
So, but in the, how do you, what's the dictionary to go from one picture to another?
You mean the one throat?
No, to relate, you know, oh. 4D, so what's hopping through the...
Imagination, I guess, as your paper states, if I represent this as a Randall Sunder model with a UV brain here, and these are two IR brains...
Sure, that's why I'm asking. In that kind of setup, I can imagine that what's happening is basically that, you know, I'm having energy stored in one case, and then that sort of a bit has a certain behavior, and then it decays through these couplings, mediated, turns on energy deposited in some other protein. On the other hand, when people draw, and I'm, so this is a general question just based on my ignorance of the statements in recent literature. People normally write down in these potentials, okay, you know, phi is basically interbrain separation and so on and so forth, right, in some ways. And then if I accept that language, then I think I'm supposed to assume that as phi changes its value, then certain brains are getting closer together. Then it sort of sounds like there is actually a brain that's moving from one throat to another in some way.
Yeah, so you're anticipating the rest of my talk also. Maybe, I think.
All right.
Maybe. So ask me again in a couple slides.
Okay, all right.
No, that's a good...
Means you're doing a good job.
or what I'm doing is obvious. I'm not sure. Okay, so I guess I've already said all this. Let me skip ahead. So one thing that's sort of interesting, if we can realize a potential like this coming from that model, is long ago Abbott wrote a paper suggesting that if we did have sort of an axion-like potential, this might be a way to explain the cosmological constant problem. The idea here would be that as I tunnel or roll down to these towards the minima, at some point the ability to tunnel would get suppressed and I would get stuck at some point that's slightly above the potential being zero. And so if such constructions come from string theory, this might be a way to sort of investigate Abbott's original proposal. I also should advertise my collaborators, this is now called chain inflation. And so in chain inflation, you have a similar, it's basically Abbott's idea applied to the string landscape. So that's the work of Katie Fries, Jim Liu, and Doug Spreuler. Okay, so now sort of I think what Nemanja was suggesting.
Does it really get stuck?
Well, this is going to be that's the end of my talk.
But, I'll ask you that.
But I don't know the answer. So.
Right.
Okay, so I've been drawing a lot of pictures. Let me try to say something a little bit quantitative. Some time ago, Busan Polchinski sort of wrote down a proposal for how we can make such a transition through a landscape. So the basic notion is that if I turn on some fluxes associated with D3 brains, well, not necessarily associated with D3 brains, but some four-dimensional four-form flux in four dimensions. Of course, this can only be proportional to the epsilon tensor. I have Q as the charge of the objects that are generating the flux. And then I have some number n, which is like the winding number, and I is the different species you can have. So Brown and Teitelboim, some time ago, suggested the idea that I could start at energy levels and I could decay the cosmological constant by nucleating membranes. But the problem with that was, if I wanted any hope of explaining the lambda problem today, I needed to explain a really small spacing between these states. And with one flux turned on, as they turned on, you couldn't explain this. But what Polchinski and Busso went on to say was that we know in the string landscape that there's thousands of fluxes. In the four-dimensional theory that this flux lives in, it's resulting from a compactification of six dimensions, lots of cycles, lots of fluxes, D-brains, M-brains, everything, and all those contribute to flux. And so by taking into consideration a sum over all the fluxes, then we can get the spacing right in principle, and we can explain why any bare ADS, so this is actually negative, any bare cosmological constant will be uplifted to some de Sitter value, now this becomes a problem of the number of fluxes that are in your theory. But at the very least, it explains the spacing between these levels would be explained by the number of membranes, for example, in your theory. So the idea is that as I make a transition, this is a static configuration locally, but globally I can pass through these membranes and it lowers the value of lambda. So in this sense, the flux makes lambda dynamical. So this is the basic setup. And each time I go down a level, I reduce the flux quanta by one, and this will then take me closer to having lambda equal to zero. So this was the Busso-Polchinski mechanism. And the energy drop associated with such a thing, if n is large, it basically goes as n q squared, where q is the charge of the objects in my theory, the non-perturbative objects, which I have to calculate. So does that...
But the statement is that q can be small enough?
Right.
It's not quantized in any way?
Right. Okay, so the assumption is that that this object is quantized, n and q. Mm-hmm. And that's not at all clear, of course, from the four-dimensional point of view. But what they pointed out was if I... because it's string theory, I have to start in 10 dimensions. And if I compactify these objects, so for example, if I start with some M5 brain and I compactify to 4 dimensions, then the tension of this object in 4 dimensions will look like this, where M11 is the 11-dimensional scale, V3 is the volume of some 3-cycle that I had on my extra dimensions, and then the 11-dimensional scale is related to the Planck scale by the dilaton, which is this 10 to the minus 3. And so at the end of the day, when I do this, the energy spacing, if I turn on 1,000 fluxes, which is reasonable in string theory, then the energy spacing of these levels is about 10 to the minus 7. And to find Q, you just use the BPS condition that the charge is related to the tension. So it's how you set up the extra dimensions. Of course, this is not at all appealing because...
small enough to... cosmological constant is.
Yeah, we got a way.
Smaller.
We got a way to go.
Yeah,
that's definitely true. In fact, let me see if. Yeah, so now I'll go to this idea. So what has been suggested by my collaborators is that if the spacing between these levels was small enough, then in the early universe, this should be more like being in a solid. So the lowest energy state would be given by the block wave function, not the actual minimum around one, not the actual value of the energy around one minimum. So we know from Bloch's theorem that if we want to find the lowest energy state of a solid, we needed to consider all the degenerate minima. And for example, in the Busso-Polchinski paper, they actually viewed it as a problem that they were getting large degeneracy or favorable. They viewed this as a statistical setup. And the fact that I have a large degeneracy of flux quanta, so this is just the plane of two of these flux numbers, of the 1,000, and I can just see in this two-dimensional plane of the configuration space, this red circle represents values that would have helped solve the cosmological constant. And they were arguing that if any of these points fall in the circle, that degeneracy helps make this more statistically preferred, and then you make some hand-waving argument about the anthropic principle. But here, what Kane, Perry, and... Zaitkov have suggested is that if I have a 1,000-dimensional configuration space, I'm going to have a large number of degeneracies, and then I need to calculate the block wave function that that I would then minimize to get the true vacuum state. So this is just out of a solid state textbook. If I take the naive cosmological constant or vacuum energy, and then I do this calculation, then I'm going to have this correction factor that actually acts to lower the energy. And all you have to do is the challenge is calculating the Euclidean action for this. And so if you just plug in some numbers,
by the Euclidean, what is involved in that Euclidean?
I'll actually get back to this in another context and explain. But the basic idea is that if I calculate the effect of all these minima superposition, theta is the angle parameter between the minima, then if I minimize this value theta, it will subtract from here and lower the energy. So for example, if I start with a Hubble scale that's around 10 to the 15 GeV, and now here's the step, if I have 10 to the 12 degenerate vacua in the space of many, many vacua, so now I've gone beyond the normal 1,000, I'm looking at 10 to the 100, mm-hmm. which is starting to get into the numbers that people are talking about today. In fact, they're usually higher than this, I suppose. Then I can actually get a vacuum energy that would be 10 to the minus 3, what we want.
So let's see, is D suppose, I'm lost.
So D is the number of vacua that we can view as being connected to
and
in
n,
a given one.
And
N is the total number of vacua. So in this picture, N would be all the blue dots, and the red circle would be the, So it's just, it's kind of
the value of S sub D that you're going to explain to us.
But the claim is with this, that in their paper, they do this calculation for this S. It's also going to be related to the vacuum tunneling, which I'll talk about. But it's basically the balance action that connects the... You need to minimize the Euclidean action to find the connectedness.
But this
it's an instanton correction.
This rho zero does depend upon the value of S sub D.
Yes. But this is just the instanton action,
mm-hmm.
essentially.
Yeah.
But then if I plug in these numbers, that is the value I'll get for rho.
Yeah, okay.
And what also is sort of interesting about this is... If such an idea is true, then this superposition would actually give you a band structure to the early universe. And so you could sort of view inflation as starting at some high level and then cascading down through these different energy bands until we get to the minimum one, which once upon a dream could be actually the value of the cosmological constant today. Of course, there's lots of subtleties. So this is just sort of my one slide on that. So are there any questions about that? So if anything, the upshot of this message is that if we're looking for the naive estimate of the vacuum energy, we need to consider non-perturbative physics that connects all these vacua if there are a lot of vacua. And a superposition of these could actually explain why the value of lambda is so small, and we might be over-guessing it based on our fundamental theory.
I have a general question about this, and if you want to leave it to later, it's fine, but since you asked, I'll put it out there. So when I see this kind of discussion in the block waves and all that, I feel that there must be some analysis you do, and I must be able to figure it out for the metals to start with, but where there's some trade-off between different interactions where you could either sort of decohere into one minimum and not see the others, or end up in these other states being the fundamental.
So that's
sort of real physical states you want to look at. And has anyone thought about that, and is there an argument why it goes one way or the other?
So that's the biggest thing that me and Gordy argue about.
Okay.
So that's what we're trying to understand. I don't see Schrodinger cats running around the room today.
Yeah.
Then we have this idea that if the transition's fast, maybe it gets frozen. I don't know.
But your point is a very good point. So what is the number that's small or large to tell me I get to do that for metals? It must be that basically the electrons are in delocalized states, that they're not, somehow the force from these potential wells isn't large or something.
Well, my attack on this has actually been, I don't know how far I have
compared to the decohering.
I being the young, uneducated person, I wanted to go into string theory and ask this question instead, because, again, I think in Nemanja's paper, going back to this picture, I can ask how coupled the operators in this throat are to these, and I should see by coupling this to gravity that there's some decay of the ability for this throat to talk to this one. And in the case I'm talking about, I guess I have a whole ring of these, and I should be able to calculate the as time evolves
all these
the decoherence
that contribute,
yeah,
or not to that.
But I think, I mean, certainly, I guess the early universe inflation picture, we would all be living somewhere like here, where it would be possible to talk. But as you're saying, we know that inflation takes quantum fluctuations and makes them classical. And so you would think that this would be naturally decoherent. Yeah, I agree, absolutely. That's a good point.
There's lots of degrees of freedom that could
Yeah.
Sort of, yeah, destroy relations.
Yeah, yeah.
Is this question the same as the question about what is S sub E, or is it different?
That depends on who you ask. No, it certainly should be in there. Because
can you use S?
Well, it should be in the calculation, but so again, this is the basically you have these two minima, and they're being connected by these instantons. So it's the balance from one to the other to the other. And the idea would be that if in this decoherence, that would break down, that description would break down, mm-hmm. and you'd be left with one. And yeah, so this should essentially that should go to infinity, I suppose. Yeah. No, that's absolutely. So that's work in progress, I should be saying. Okay, so now I wanted to say a bit more about first-order transitions, sort of going back to this cascading potential. So just a few reminders about how a first-order phase transition proceeds. So I have to say, when I first started learning about this, it was sort of irritating because I've never seen sort of a convincing summary of how this process really works, except maybe in a condensed matter physics book. So usually you see this picture for old inflation if I have just the ball sitting here, it tunnels to the bottom here, and that represents our universe forming. It turns out that the real story is much, much more complicated. So I start with some condensate of the field that lives in the false vacuum, and then I slowly evolve bubbles at the same energy over to here, and then the bubble will begin to roll down the potential and end up at the minimum if you're lucky. And so the process that's actually physically happening is something we know every day. I have a bubble that forms in the new phase. This bubble wall will store the energy difference between the false vacuum and the new vacuum, some portion of it in the form of latent heat. All the energy will be stored in this bubble wall, and then the bubble wall will expand, and in this case, because the scales are high, it will be a relativistic process. And then if we're lucky, these bubbles will find each other, coalesce, percolate, and create the new phase. However, because these are, if these bubbles are large enough that they're on the order of the Hubble scale, in other words, the scale of gravity, then gravitational effects become important. And, for example, in the case of old inflation, this ruined it because the de Sitter phase kept the bubbles from touching each other, because that's what de Sitter does. It dilutes things out. And that's why the first order of transition couldn't complete. So sort of to be a little bit quantitative, there's basically two scales in this problem. The first one is the height, or this latent heat, is the difference between the two minima, the difference in the potential. But then I also have the size of the barrier. And if the condition for this to be a first order phase transition is simply that the barrier is high enough, the only way I can proceed is by tunneling. But it turns out that, of course, the larger this is compared to the energy difference in the potential, the more first order it is. And the more first order something is in cosmology, the better as far as producing gravitational waves, because you can imagine the more violent the transition is, the more signatures you have left behind. But it turns out, makes sense. Perhaps everybody does know this, but I find the, especially if you get into more complicated examples, this idea of the condensate maybe isn't highly advertised in the simple arguments you hear. So if you actually want to calculate the decay rate from the false vacuum to the new vacuum, one way to do this is by using the Euclidean approach, which was developed by Coleman, Callan, and then later Coleman and DeLuccia. So the idea is that gamma here is the decay rate. I have some A prefactor that depends on the microphysics that's involved, determinants of the quantum field theory that you happen to be looking at, but it's roughly the related to the energy difference of the minimum and the maximum, which is there. And then the goal is to calculate this bounce action, which is the action for an instanton that interpolates between the old vacuum and where you're going, eventually the new vacuum. So you look at the difference between the bounce action and the false vacuum, and that tells you the probability of decaying into the new vacuum. So the way you do this is you look at the Euclidean potential. I'll start at some point here, and I want to find the action of the solution that goes over to the other side at exactly the same energy and just barely makes it there and then comes back, and that tells me quantitatively how to calculate the decay rate. So enough about that. The bottom line is that the most important thing is the dimensionless decay rate. So this is the decay rate per Hubble volume per time. And the problem of the old inflation model is worked out in much detail by Guth and Weinberg, can be explained in the following way. So the probability of a point remaining in the false vacuum and is, as a function of time, is given by this expression here. So roughly, the lifetime of a state in the false vacuum is given by this beta, dimensionless decay rate, and the Hubble time. And so if I want this process to end, if I want to emerge in a universe, in other words, get a graceful exit from this universe, I need to have this dimensionless parameter on the order of 1. But in order to get enough E-foldings for inflation to last long enough, I needed beta to be much less than 1. And so roughly, if I drop the E-foldings requirement, the requirement that I need is, in order for the bubbles to percolate and the phase transition to complete, I need the number of E-foldings will be less than or on the order of 1/3. So this leads to the following idea. If I have these sort of chain potentials, this chain inflation model, the idea is that if I start at one of these and I keep tunneling through, then all I need to do is get 1/3 of an E-folding in each minimum, and then I need, in other words, enough of these so I get 60 E-folds by the time I get to the bottom. And so you can also imagine the limit where the potential hill, or in other words, the differences in the landscape between the energy scale can make these very small, so this almost can proceed like regular inflation, like natural inflation or chaotic inflation, where I'm just slow rolling to the bottom, but I have a small potential, so I have a little bit of tunneling, so it's like a little bit of friction. And you can imagine playing around with the interpolation between old inflation and new inflation. But typically, we saw from the Polchinski-Busa model, these transitions should be weakly first order because the energy separation would be very small. And moreover, what makes the analysis a little bit more tractable is that the average radius of a bubble will be much low, much smaller than the scale of gravity, so this will proceed like a flat space calculation. So roughly, the radius of the bubble goes like 1 over the energy scale, the spacing between the phi and the Cassi parameter, which was the height of the potential. So what this allows us to do is to go into the realm of cosmology and sort of this. So far, I've been talking about the microphysical description of what's going on, but because the scales are much smaller than the Hubble radius, and eventually I wanted to talk about cosmological perturbations, which are much larger than the Hubble radius, then this suggests that we can do this coarse graining and just treat these bubbles as, remember, they're highly relativistic, they'll act like a bath of radiation. So in other words, we replace this sort of tunneling potential with some slow roll potential, although it doesn't have to be slow rolling because the effect of radiation could be to slow down the potential. So are there any questions so far? Actually, what time is this seminar supposed to be over?
How much time do we need?
Well, I'm wondering, because I could even stop here. Because the cosmological, I'm halfway there, so this is taking longer than I expected. I guess I can summarize.
The question is whether we should just continue this on another day if we're sort of halfway through.
Or I can summarize if it's boring.
By the way, if you're wondering about time and so on, I don't know if we have anything earlier this week, but I was thinking of inviting you to my research meeting on Friday morning at 11. That's a good time for people. But I think it would be nice. And so we could even just continue this. But that's like halfway through your visit, so if we can move it earlier, there's another slot. I don't know how Tuesday's looking. We've got something booked on Tuesday.
Yes.
Already. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But Wednesday at 11, is that a conflict?
Well, I could actually finish this in 5 minutes and give you the gist of the idea.
Really, maybe we could reconvene.
Right, so probably that's like a good plan. So, you can wrap up this story as, in a coherent way, and then, if you feel like it, I think there is interest, then you can give us the other part.
Yeah, I definitely love to have you at my research meeting on Friday, but I think it'd be better if we could get an earlier time to, just because the more we hear about your work before your visit gets underway, the better.
Okay.
So we can work on that.
Okay. So let me just try to quickly
just to try
summarize.
Shall we preliminarily try Wednesday at 11?
Yeah, it sounds like it might work for me. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know it can work for me. Yeah, so okay. So far it sounds good for Wednesday at 11.
Yeah. Okay, so how to summarize? okay, so basically
the problem is I still have a question. I should ask her now.
Maybe we should let him you know, provoke us in the next 5 minutes. Get us fired up so we all come to Wednesday.
That's okay. That's challenging.
And then you can take questions now.
Yeah. And remember, the best way to provoke people is to insult them. So if you dare.
I'm not very good at that, but I'll try. Right. Okay.
No, just tell us the.
Okay, so the basic idea is
that's most exciting to you,
about. Okay, so the basic idea is that this sort of motivates having a model that, if you allow me to coarse grain everything, you have a model of inflation with radiation around. And this actually isn't a new idea. It's something called warm inflation, but it hasn't got too much attention. One reason is because of a lot of fine-tuning. But there's a regime where some of this could proceed by tunneling and some could proceed by slow roll. Now, usually when you talk about tunneling, people don't care because bubble nucleation, bubbles, they're very inhomogeneous, and you expect density perturbations to be on the order of 1, and we know that's not true. They're more like 10 to the minus 5 or 10 to the minus 11. But in this model, because the bubbles are much smaller than the Hubble scale and it's acting like a bit of radiation, not only do you get the density fluctuations, these fluctuations that go into the CMB, they go into setting up large-scale structure, they can come out the right magnitude. And in fact, there's sort of an analogy with slow roll inflation. So let me skip all this. So I guess you're all familiar with the idea of the slow roll parameter, measuring the slope of the potential in new inflation. So in new inflation, standard slow roll, I've written in this sort of strange way using the the density of the kinetic term. But so if I have some kinetic energy around, the portion of that compared to the total density is usually the slow roll parameter in one parameterization. In this model where you have the bubbles around in the form of radiation, you have another channel of, in some sense, decay of the potential, which is the form of radiation. And so you can write down a generalized slow roll parameter. And the condition for inflation, of course, is just that this epsilon is less than 1. So in other words, this is sort of straightforward. You don't want too much rolling in the scalar field. You don't want too much radiation because you want the vacuum term to dominate. And then I get this vacuum term. The amount of vacuum energy in the total density is decaying through some coupling to radiation and to a kinetic term. And then the kinetic term also couples to the radiation. So in other words, I have two channels of decay of the vacuum energy. So if you like, there's two ways for the cosmological constant to decay into a kinetic energy of a field and in radiation. But of course, this will alter the way I do perturbations. In particular, there was a paper by Gary Hsu recently with this in mind. The idea is that you can actually have a trans-Planckian type effect where when I prepare my initial state, I could have something. I would not just have quantum fluctuations, which usually give rise to fluctuations during inflation, which you could think of as being associated with some Hawking temperature. You actually have thermal fluctuations as well, and there can be a playoff between the two. It turns out that pure thermal fluctuations probably aren't going to work, mainly because then you'd have to write down thermal effective potential, and it becomes a mess. This is the problem with warm inflation, and you can't get good inflation models out of it. But if you're at this sort of regime where you're tunneling and you're not tunneling, then in that regime, you can have a little bit of radiation in the initial state. And so this actually shows up in the CMB power spectrum, and you could actually measure the presence of this radiation. In addition, if you have two fluids around...
That's not trans-Planckian. You just meant to say initial condition.
Yeah, I got to be careful. You're right. Okay, so, and then the other interesting point is, So as you can see, there's a lot of type. So this is sort of the results minus this. Okay. So the basic point is the following: if I have this radiation present, one thing that hasn't been done in these sort of chain inflation or washboard potentials is taking the radiation into effect. And in particular, once the radiation density becomes larger than the vacuum density, inflation stops. So if this happens before I get to the bottom of the potential, then the dynamics of what's going to happen with this rolling ball is not clear. And in particular, you could have it stuck like Abbott originally envisioned, which would explain the cosmological constant problem today. Quite frequently, people criticize chain inflation models because they say that, well, how do you end inflation? But that's, again, so the provoking statement here is I'm claiming if you take radiation into consideration, this could alter everything. But it's not clear whether it works or not. The bottom line is, if you calculate the power spectrum, the CMB spectrum for these models, you get the standard slow roll inflation result, except now this epsilon that you had everywhere is replaced by the value of the, not just the rolling of the scalar field at the time this mode crosses outside of the Hubble radius, you also have the value of this radiation when it crosses outside the Hubble radius. And by transplanking effect, what I meant, or initial conditions, is that when you're preparing your state initially, since it's not just a pure quantum state, it's a mixed state, then this is going to alter the Bunch-Davies vacuum and give you some sort of mixture of radiation. Whether you can see that, probably not. I don't know. But it's probably
just
worth it.
Just a vacuum, that's all.
Right. So this is probably a good place to stop, except to say that the other thing that's interesting with these fluid models is now there's a sound speed and a sound horizon that comes in. And the sound horizon is not the Hubble radius. So when a perturbative mode evolves larger than the sound horizon, it can freeze out. And so it alters things like the tensor to scalar ratio. Now you see that the CS appears. The standard slow roll result is 16 epsilon, but now there's this parameter which in principle can depend on time and has to do with the presence of the radiation and how it grows in time. So if you have substantial radiation around at the time that the mode 60 E folds before the end of inflation occurs, which is what we observe on the sky today, if there's a substantial amount of radiation, the actual tensor to scalar ratio can be larger. And this is important because generically in string theory, if I write down a model that makes sense in effective field theory, this ratio is not observable. But in these models with radiation present, then if C is large enough, we could, or if it has the right dynamics, we can see that some signature coming from this. Of course, it can't be greater than 1, so I should be careful. But okay, so let me stop there.
In this last application, you do mean that your chain of inflations got interrupted for a long period of time, so that radiation could build up to become significant.
Yes.
It's like you had an early stage, and then something happens, and then you have the late stage. For those calculations, probably a useful thing to do is, there is a paper by Deruel and Mukhanov that actually connects the perturbations to junction conditions using for the setup just like that.
Nemanja, I guess I don't understand how you concluded that it has to get interrupted here.
Suppose inflation lasted 100 defaults uninterrupted. Mm-hmm. So before you got, you had to undergo 40 defaults of inflation until you got to the point where you are seeing the last 60.
Mm-hmm.
Radiation scales is 1/8 to the 4th. All right, so whatever radiation had to have been absolutely humongous at the beginning of the inflation that lasted 100 in order to survive after all the dilution.
Actually, I need to say something. Yeah, but I have
exactly.
To.
Exactly. So,
I'm actually very confused.
No. This is because I skipped all the cosmology details.
Do you want?
I want the radiation to keep building up because the thing keeps decaying to it. And
that's
because each time I go down, I keep producing bubbles, and the bubbles keep acting like radiation. That's the real difference.
So it's some steady state.
That's why I didn't understand Nemanja's statement. Yeah.
But that is a very delicate balance.
Yes,
this is the Baron Munchausen trick, right? I mean, the guy can't really pull himself out of the mud just by yanking his
head. Yeah, the thing I'm relying on is the Busse-Polchinski argument, but...
So it's almost anthropic.
So
the way I would say it is basically this is what interruption means. The interruption is literally this process whereas you might sort of balance them off. And because the moment you start inflating with lambda dominant, radiation goes away no matter how fast you're producing it. If you're producing it fast enough, then you will not be inflating.
We got to talk about that.
This is the next segment of this talk, right?
As long as you satisfy the coarse grained description, which is thermodynamics, which is no energy conditions working.
But I'm thinking about it, I'm getting comfortable with Nemanja's words. That somehow, if it's really steady, it's either inflating and coming to dominant, or it's radiation and it's not.
Let's put it this way: this warm inflation by Arjun Berera and friends that sort of played with it essentially found
that
you have to inject something like 15,000 degrees of freedom per e-fold in order to keep inflation competitive with acceleration. In fact, it wasn't Berera.
Wait, you mean?
Exactly. So you have to basically keep inventing these things out of.
No. So here's warm inflation. I agree with you. In fact, I don't have a... So this paper, Linde and Yokoyama, they say what you're saying. And so I would argue that this first regime, I didn't get to say any of this, but this regime I would say is not very plausible. This is the one I'm interested in, because it seems to be the one that corresponds to bubble nucleations in the landscape. And in that model, if you just kill the scalar... So here's a graph. So this is the region that gives you 60 E-foldings, and these are the... So I guess this is where gamma doesn't change at all. This is where the decay rate increases. This is where it decays. And these are the different scenarios that give you 60 E-foldings. So I would say warm inflation is this region, which has nothing. You can't... It's not plausible. The region we're talking about looking at is in here. And the model looks like this. So basically, we need gamma to be on the order of the Hubble scale. And so then the decay of the vacuum energy, so I have no kinetic term, the decay of the vacuum energy goes into the radiation density, and then it's the ratio of gamma to H that's the parameter term. And it is tuned because this is on the order, but it's on the order of 1, so from a particle physics point of view, it's not really tuned.
The tricky part is that what I would just, if you wrote down this equation for what you call radiation, and then you found that gamma rho lambda is big enough to compensate for the redshift, I just wouldn't call that radiation.
Oh, well.
You see what I'm saying?
Well, no, I agree with you, except that now I'm trying to describe bubbles. That's why I buy it. Without the bubbles, I agree with you. If I was just pumping radiation, it's kind of contrived, but...
The point is that if you're dumping so much stuff into what you call rho r by the decay of rho lambda, then if eventually you will, what you call rho r will not be diluted, and so actually that itself may start playing a role of something like, negative pressure thing in the universe, and you might call that a very funny dark energy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I don't know. Those are details.
Yeah. No.
I mean, your main point being that this may alter the description of the vacuum, I think is correct.
Well, the other point, which I I'll say when I give the rest, but the main thing is that we know that the slow roll potential is fine-tuned. This has some fine-tuning, but the argument is that this one's not as fine-tuned as the other. Because there you have two fine-tunings, the slope and the curvature, and here you only have one, which is the decay level. And you should be able to calculate that on the string landscape, and then the number of flux vacua should take away the problem of the tuning. Anyway, I'm sorry for going over so much.
this tends to happen because we ask lots of questions. At least I do, because I don't know anything.